Welcome. Welcome means we are all invited to be here fully and completely without reservations. When the Buddha was awakened, and long ago, Rohatsu, the first Rohatsu, Sesshin, shortly afterwards, he met some of his old friends, and they heard the Dharma, and there wasn't yet really a Sangha, but they naturally wanted to form one. So those first friends were like, can I join your little group here? Can I join your Dharma community? Can we make a Dharma community? And the way the Buddha would ordain the first disciples as monks was he just would say, welcome, monk. And that was the ordination ceremony. Ehi bhikkhu in Pali. And later, as time went on, as the Sangha grew, naturally when things grow, they get more complicated. So then they had to do all these background checks and all these precepts and ceremonial procedures. But for a while, apparently, the early Sangha was just the Buddha's. When people would ask to be ordained, he'd just say, welcome, monk. And that was it. Welcome to the community of awakening. Welcome today, all of us. The thought arose in my mind for this session to explore together a teaching by Keizan Zenji called the Zazen Yojinki. Anyone know that? Has anyone ever read the Zazen Yojinki?
Maybe, I don't know.
Uh-huh. I'll tell you when I
okay. Well, this is great, then. I thought, well, maybe everyone's really tired of the Zazen Yojinki, but I guess not. And this kind of thing, it's about Zazen, so I think that the best time to explore these kind of teachings, I think, is in Sesshin. I think the last Rohatsu Sesshin, we looked at the Fukan Zazengi of Dogen's Zazen instructions. This is like the sequel, four generations after Dogen in Japan, was Keizan Zenji, a great admirer of Dogen and his teachings. So he wrote, it's, you know, in the same style as the Fukan Zazengi, and he quotes the Fukan Zazengi a lot, but it's longer and more detailed and more practical details. You know, about if we're too excited or too sleepy, things like this, and also more inspiration about what Zazen is. It's a beautiful treatise, and it's an important part of Soto Zen lineage. So let's do it. We got 7 days. It's a little bit long, but we can see. So, we started this practice period with Keizan's teachings, the transmission of light record. So we can finish it with Keizan as well. And as I mentioned, he was the fourth generation after Dogen brought the Soto lineage to Japan. And One modern Soto scholar said it like, in Dogen's time, Dogen's like strongest intention was to establish this new way, this new type of practice in Japan called Zen. Buddhism had been in Japan for a long time, but Zen was something new. This special transmission outside the scriptures, pointing directly to mind, so we can see our true nature and be Buddha. So Dogen was about establishing this new way, this new lineage, and he had somewhat rough time of it, actually. If you know Dogen's story, it's almost like he got kicked out of Kyoto, run out of town by other schools. But by Keizan's time, Zen was actually established in Japan a few generations later. So this scholar William Botiford says, when Dogen was about establishing Zen, Keizan was about clarifying Zen that was already established. People were all doing it. There were Zen monasteries and temples all around Japan already, just within 100 years. But he wanted to say, let's clarify what this is, especially Zazen, what this is. So that's like the kind of heart of Zen practice. And when I think of Keizan, I often think of like our time now in America, because we're kind of like fourth generation ancestors. The ancestors in the room are like fourth, fifth, and fifth generation after sixth generation, I guess, after Suzuki Roshi. And Suzuki Roshi has many parallels to Dogen, right? He brought Soto Zen. Now there's various Soto Zen lineages, but he brought our particular one to America and did the work of establishing it. And it worked. It kind of stuck. It grew. And so now these next generations, we could say our work is keep establishing it, but also keep clarifying it as it grows and expands into the culture. So we have, you know, Zen perfume and Zen chocolate and stuff like that. We've got to clarify what this Zen is. And maybe a little bit around the same time. So Dogen, could say he was really establishing Zen most actively from about 1240 to 1250. And then Keizan was like around 1300, around 50 years later. So it's kind of similar. We could even go so far as to say, I think that not really Buddhism as a whole, which was already pervading Japan, but Zen has maybe spread more quickly in America than it did in Japan at that time. As we read the records, it seems like the Soto Zen lineage in Japan after 50 years was still pretty small group of people, and just, you know, a handful of temples in these four generations. Maybe there were some other smaller ones, but the larger communities were not many, and we know of all the ancestors at that time. So one of Dogen's women students, Dogen had various women practitioner disciples. One of them's name was Myochi, a lay woman student, devoted practitioner in Dogen's community. And she had a daughter named Akon, who's one of our women ancestors that we chant, right? Akon. And Akon had this dream that she swallowed the light of the sun, and then the next day she found out she was pregnant, and she made this vow to name my baby become a great Zen practitioner, because that's what she was into. And during the first, I think maybe like 7 months of her pregnancy, she did 1,000 prostrations every day to the Guan Yin, Avalokiteshvara Bodhisattva, with this, to invigorate this vow. And then little baby Kazan was born. and soon after, we don't know about the father here. And I think some claim that the father was a monk, and at this time the monks and the nuns didn't marry, but maybe they were still practicing together somehow.
Monkey business.
But soon after Akon gave birth to Kazan, she became an ordained practitioner too. She became a Zen priest. And when Kazan was 8 years old, she gave him to a Heiji monastery. And so we can tell from her story, this was not to like get rid of him because it was too much trouble. This was out of her devotion. I want him to be a great practitioner. Let's start him young. And apparently they weren't at all estranged. They visited all the time. She loved him a lot. And they saw each other, but it's like, why don't you grow up in the monastery here? Where her mother had been and was still a student of Dogen. At some point Dogen died, but Eheji was still the Soto practice place. And and then later I think that Myochi also got ordained. So Kazan's mother and grandmother were both Zen priests. And then Kazan also is, one of the things he's known for is having lots of women student practitioners, and who he really encouraged and helped start like kind of women's lineage in Japan. So, Mokufu Sonin, one of our ancestors we chant, was Kazan's disciple, who was a wealthy lay patron who, gave the land to build Yokoji, one of Kazan's monasteries. And later, she got ordained also with Kazan. And Shozen was Mokufu Sonin's mother, and she also got ordained by Kazan. And Myosho Enkan was Kazan's cousin, and also ordained by Kazan. So these are all on our list of women ancestors, right? And Ekyu, another one of our women ancestors, was not ordained by Kazan, but she was already a priest of another lineage, early Zen lineage in Japan. But she came to practice with Kazan, and she was the first woman to receive Dharma transmission in Soto Zen in Japan, Ekyu. So Kazan enabled that to happen. So this was the times, the early generations of practitioners of Soto Zen in Japan. And at some point in one practice period, Keizan gave the daily, daily talks that became the transmission of light record. They have that feeling like he's telling stories about the ancestors, and they're kind of spontaneous. Sometimes he gets super sidetracked on various stories. They have a kind of oral feeling, whereas I think this Zazen Yojinki is more like a written treatise, like presenting Zazen, like the Fuka and Zazengi. So Zazen Yojinki, one translation calls it what to be aware of in Zazen. Zazen is sitting meditation. Yo is an exclamation when we're greeting somebody, like welcome. We say yo in English. But in Japanese, yo is the same as the you in jijiyu. Jijiyu zamai, which is like the self receiving and employing samadhi. So the you or yo is like employing or using. So, and jin or shin is mind or heart. So, it's zazen, using the mind, ki is like a treatise or, essay. So, you could say, it's an essay on, how to use the mind in zazen. Like kind of literally. But, yojin, is also like, as a compound, means like guidelines or cautions. Just outside of Buddhism in a regular Japanese dictionary, it's like guidelines or cautions. When you break it down, it means to how you use the mind, interestingly. Dogen has an essay called Gakudo Yojin Shu, which is guidelines for studying the way, or how to use the mind when studying the way. So, what to be aware of in Zazen. We have one translation from Yasuda Joshu Daimen Roshi and his American or Canadian student Anzan Hoshin Roshi. They're kind of unusual. These translations are all over their website, and I like their did a lot of translations of Dogen and Keizan, and I like their style. It's not totally literal, but it's kind of exuberant. Anzan Roshi, the Canadian teacher, is also a Tibetan Dzogchen practitioner, so I feel a connection to him in that way. So he also has translated some meditation treatises from Tibetan. And I think he gives the Dzogchen treatises a little bit of a Dzogchen flavor for those who know these. They're almost the same anyway, really. And we have another translation from Shohaku Okamura, an unpublished one, where he very nicely like puts in all the references to Dogen and other texts that Keizan's referring to or quoting. And there's one by Thomas Cleary in Timeless Spring. Maybe those are the English translations. So Zazen Yojinki, written by Sramana, or monk Keizan Jokin, about somewhere around 1300, a while ago. So it begins, Zazen, or sitting, is the way to open and clarify the mind ground and to rest at ease in your true nature. This translation from Anzan says, sitting is the way to clarify the ground of experience and to rest at ease in your true nature. So, the ground of mind, the ground of experience is not exactly this mind, it's more like the ground of this mind, the foundation of this mind, the source of this mind. Right. I heard a brief commentary on the Zazen Yojinki at one of these SCBA conferences. I don't know if Patrick was there. It was a Keizan celebration conference where we all these talks from scholars and teachers about Keizan and Shohaku Okamura. That's where I got this translation. He started teaching it, but he only got the one sentence. And it was this sentence, though. But he said this mind ground is also called, in Zen, it's called mind ground, mind source, mind nature, or mind essence. And each one has a different character. And they're all, and it's the inconceivable source from which everything arises, including the conceptual mind. So we call it Buddha nature, or the nature of mind. The ground of experience is loosely translated here. And so we could talk about this in infinite ways. Last night I was talking about it as the eternal now, eternal, everlasting, ever-present now. Not the little moment between two other little moments that arises and ceases, but the ground for that moment and that moment and that moment. The unchanging, eternal, ever-present ground that we are living in right now. That has no beginning or end, and it's always now. It doesn't move through time. It's always now. This one. And it's also always here. Again, not the here that's like a particular point in space between other points in space, but the all-pervading here that includes all places and is always here. This here. So this here, this now. That's actually ungraspable, but undeniable, ever-present, all-pervading, boundless, here, now, which isn't hidden in the slightest, right? Because here we are, now. And yet, it often seems to be obscured by our thinking about other times and other places, which from the point of view of here and now, this here and now that I'm speaking of, there are no other times and places, right? But we think that there are, and therefore when we think that there are other times and places, it's harder to appreciate this ground of here and now. But Sashin helps us to appreciate this here and now and include all our thoughts of other times and other places in the inconceivable ground of here and now. So this, on that first Rohatsu, we know that story of the Buddha's big night, his maybe his conceptual thoughts about other times and other places were bombarding him. The attack of Mara. Mara often takes the form of conceptual thought of other times and places, right? And Buddha, the story goes, touched the ground during this onslaught. Sometimes it's the Bhumi Sparsha Mudra, this hand mudra. Sometimes we say earth touching, but more literally, Bhumi is not really exactly earth. It's, I think, most literal good translation is ground. So maybe it has a kind of a double meaning that we usually interpret as he touched the earth, but literally he touched the ground of being. He touched the ever-present now and the all-pervading here. And Mara couldn't stand that. The Bhumi Sparsha Mudra. So this mind ground, the Bhumi of experience. Zazen is the way to open and clarify. Clarify is a nice character in Japanese because it really also means like illuminate or shine. What's your name, Kathy? Bright song? Myoka? Yeah, it's not myo. So it can be an adjective or or here it's like a verb. The character is the sun and the moon put together. So all kinds of light, subtle light and bright light. It means clarity, light, and also means to clarify and to shine. And it also means knowing. Because in Sanskrit, vidya means knowing, and avidya means ignorance. That's our usual word for delusion or ignorance is avidya. But it literally means not knowing, not being clear. In Japanese, they translate avidya as mumyo, like no light, no clarity. So, and vidya, by the way, for Korean, is the Sanskrit for Rigpa in Tibetan, which means like knowing, awareness, clarity. So sitting is the way to open and clarify the mind ground, or the way to open and illuminate the mind ground, and to rest at ease in your true nature or in your original place, literally says. To peacefully abide in your original place, which is this place, this ever-present, all-pervading place called here. Here is our original place, and here the way unfolds. This is called the display of the original face and revealing the landscape of the basic ground. I love the way Keizan talks like this. It's kind of flowery language, and I think early in my practice I would hear stuff like this and just think like, wow, that's flowery Zen language, and it sounds cool, but it's basically abstract. I think he's trying to encourage us, but it doesn't really mean anything particular to me. But now, especially when we hear the word slowly, I think these sentences are like ambrosia. And just like Dogen starts his Fukan Zazengi in the most exalted way, Keizan does too. And also like all over, I think, definitely Tibetan meditation treatises, usually start with what they call the ground, actually. They start with presenting the ground of reality first. And then they get into practical instructions about, like, put your left foot on your right foot, put your right foot in and your left foot out. Shake it all about. And that's called the path. And then the end is like the fruition. So this, sometimes they structure these texts like there's the ground, get this kind of really like cool. That ground is like where I want to live. Then, well, here's the path of how you do it. And then here's the fruition. And they'll say the fruition is really the same as the ground. When the ground is fully manifest, it's called the fruition. And it strikes me that like the Fukan Zazengi starts with, the way is basically perfect and all-pervading. How could it depend on our practice or anything? That's like the ground. And then in the middle, the path is like, put your right foot in and your left foot out. And then the end is like, your treasure store will open of itself and you will use it at will. It's like the fruition. So this is like this too. The practical nitty-gritty is like later in the middle. We start with, Zazen is the way to open and illuminate the mind ground and to peacefully abide in your original place. This is called, quote, the display of the original face, or manifesting the original face, and, quote, revealing the landscape of the basic ground, or the original ground, or revealing the scenery of the original ground. This is what Zazen is. I'll read it again, because the first is like the best. Zazen is the way to open and clarify and illuminate the ground of mind, the ground of experience, and to rest at ease in your original place, your true nature. This is called manifesting your original face, or the display of the original face, and revealing the scenery of the original ground. Which part? Yeah, interesting, huh? So maybe we get manifesting the original face before our parents were born, is this ground called here and now. We might think before our parents were born was then and there, but actually, before our parents were born, it was here and now. The ever-present here and now. So Zazen is manifesting this original face. And it's revealing the scenery or the landscape of the basic ground or original ground. So later, this will be explored, that this original face before our parents were born is not just like empty space with nothing in it. All right. In a way, we can say it is the empty space that holds everything, but everything that it holds is part of it, or is its expression or manifestation, is the display of the ground. So and Keizan has some beautiful ways of putting that. So we could say that that's, yeah, the landscape or the scenery is all of this stuff on all of us. We are the scenery, and the Zendo that we're in is like the scenery and landscape of the original ground. And our thoughts and emotions and moment-to-moment experiences are the scenery of the original ground. And Zazen reveals the scenery of the original ground. Maybe we could say we're really into the scenery all day long anyway, right? All our experiences that are happening. But Zazen reveals the scenery to be of the basic ground. It's now not just like obnoxious scenery that's passing through our mind, obnoxious or beautiful, tantalizing scenery. It's the scenery of the basic ground. Zazen reveals that that's what it kind of scenery all this stuff is. How about that? Keizan goes on. Drop off body and mind, and you will be far beyond such forms as sitting or lying down. This is kind of quoting from Fukan Zazengi, right? The Zazen I speak of, Dogen says, is not a matter of sitting or lying down. The sitting Zen I speak of is not a matter of sitting. Or it's not a matter of a particular posture, is what he's saying, right? Although it always manifests a particular posture. It's not only while we're sitting in a certain posture in the Zendo. Drop off body and mind, and you will be far beyond such forms as sitting or lying down, beyond considerations of good or bad. Transcend any divisions between ordinary people and sages, delusion and awakening, and sentient beings and Buddhas. All these dichotomies and dualities, drop off the distinctions and divisions. Putting aside all concerns, shed all attachments. This is also a quote from Dogen. We say, cast aside all involvements and cease all affairs. But then Keizan says, do nothing at all. That's a new one. Do nothing at all. Don't fabricate any things with the six senses. Or, I'd say, the six senses of seeing, hearing, tasting, smelling, touching, and thinking are like maybe open and receptive, but we're not using them to construct our own world to our liking. We're just letting the senses be. This is Zazen instruction. I think one of the more radical Zazen instructions, I think, is do nothing at all. It's pretty literal translation. What is Zazen? Just don't do anything. Who is this? Keizan says. Its name is unknown. It cannot be called body. It cannot be called mind. Trying to think of it, the thought vanishes. Trying to speak of it, words end. Even though he's going to keep trying for a while with some words. It's like a fool, like an idiot. It is as high as a mountain, as deep as the ocean, but without the mountain peak or without the ocean depths being seen. The peak of this mountain cannot be seen and the depths of this ocean cannot be seen. Its brilliance is unthinkable. But actually, more literally, we'd say, it is illumining without facing objects, which is a direct quote from Hungjer's poem of the acupuncture needle of Zazen, which I think is a beautiful line. So Keizan thought it was a beautiful line too. This Zazen is illumining without facing objects, meaning like it's just it's clear knowing, but there's nothing actually, there's no subject and object in this knowing. It's usually knowing involves knowing something that seems to be separate from the knower, and it might still appear to be like we're seeing things and hearing things, but in this illumining, the seen and the heard are nothing other than the knowing of them, or the illumining of them. The sound of the faint hum of distant traffic. A few voices are, from the perspective of Zazen, are not objects called sounds that the ear is hearing, but they are most intimately simply the hearing of them. The sounds are the knowing of them, the colors that we see, the visual perceptions are not, from the perspective of Zazen, objects of the eye faculty. They are just the seeing of them, the knowing of visions and sounds. And likewise, for thoughts are not objects of a thinking consciousness, they are just the experiencing of them, the knowing of them. And I think especially with thoughts, this is a subtle shift of perspective, but I think very, very freeing. When thoughts seem to be attacking us under our Bodhi tree, that they are actually not something that's happening to us. Right? They are just the expression of the illumination. They're the display of the original ground as thoughts. Yeah? I mean, of course this is subtle, but actually we can, we can open to this in Zazen. I think when thoughts seem to be tormenting is when it seems like they are happening to me. There's a me that's having the thoughts. The thoughts are impinging on me, and they're actually, it really can feel strongly, even they're like, the very thoughts, the very conceptual stories are creating tension in the body that I think of as me. It's amazing that thoughts can do this, huh? Because it seems that we put them at a distance to a subject that seems to be experiencing them. We split this illumination into a me that's having a thought, and that very division is tortuous. Sometimes it's nice, but it's never perfectly peaceful. How do we see through this division of subject and object? And luckily it's possible because the division is created by our conceptual thinking. It's not, if it were really a division between me and the thought object, or between me and the seen object or the heard object, if they were really divided, we would be trapped forever in a tiny dualistic world. Yes.
Strong bias that if thoughts are pleasant, you know, the
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Exactly. That's true. The division seems to be solidified and reified more when it's a negative thought, and it may be, I think, as you say, that like even a positive thought is usually seems, yeah, it kind of it just it still might make me feel quite solid, but I don't mind because it's a happy me. Right? But it also might be that we don't have so much problem with the pleasant ones because they are, in a way, this just thought is arising right now. So I'm going to have to think about it more afterwards, but I'll say it because it's arising, is that the pleasant experiences may be actually, they don't bother us so much because they're more in accord with the original ground, because the original ground, mind ground, is inherently happy. Happy is a tricky word, right? Because joy, it's inherently content. It's because, so it doesn't necessarily mean giddy happy, right? But the it's inherently content because it's inherently fulfilled. It by its very nature, it's nothing is lacking in the original, in this here, this all inclusive here and now. If we call it all inclusive, that means by definition, nothing is outside of it, right? It means nothing is lacking. So it actually is inherently fulfilled or content. It's which mean, and fulfillment is another name for happiness, actually, I think. So something we could explore. So it's not just like that the original ground is neutral. We could maybe say from a feeling perspective, in a way, it's not grasping at pleasure or averting from pain. In a way, it's neutral, but that neutrality has a positive valence. You know, and I think this is the reason. Actually, I think this is the reason why we've come to this practice in the first place. I think we want to be happy. I think we feel like this seems like it's a way, and it might be one of the greatest ways to find a kind of stable happiness, because we know how the happiness that comes through acquiring objects of experience is impermanent. We make the best of it by manipulating the objects of experience, but we know it's not reliable. And most of us in the world spend a lot of time trying to actually really make the best of it and by manipulating objects of experience. But spiritual practice is, it's not that we stop doing that. I mean, I don't think we'll stop doing that. I mean, maybe the Buddha has completely got over that. But at the same time as we're doing that, we're putting more emphasis on clarifying the original ground that is inherently fulfilled. Yeah? So anyway, it's something that we could explore about we might even say, when things are going well in our life, just because of the conditions of things are going well, we don't really need practice so much. And in a sense, I think it's true, because really it's all just about happiness. So if we could work it out with just conditioned happiness completely, then actually that'd be great. We wouldn't need practice at all. But in fact, we know we can't really. And maybe one of the problems is when we get close to being able, we get better and better at doing that. That's often when people start forgetting about practice. Don't you think? I think when it's more when we know we haven't quite worked it all out and we're not quite content, that really fuels practice. I feel like that's the case for me. And then maybe our standards for contentment get higher and higher too. So we can be like more and more content, but more and more we see that it's not quite complete. So that can be a good way too. Mm-hmm.
Translations interest me with the use of the word your original place.
Mm-hmm.
It's kind of feeling separate, that somehow this is my ground of being is different than yours, or
Is
it? And no, it's not.
Well, in the translation, actually, it doesn't say your. It says the original face.
Oh, excuse me.
But and a lot of so it's nice to look at the at the details, but sometimes in this treatise and other treatises, they do talk about your true self. The word self is used here as a kind of big self, and that self is also not personal, actually. It is that is another name for the ground of being, is the true all-inclusive self. The entire universe in 10 directions is the self of a practitioner, one Zen ancestor said. That self.
Which is kind of what makes it, for me, most challenging, recognizing the, I don't want to say impossibility, I don't know what that word means, that the all and every can touch that ground of being in my Zazen practice.
Yeah.
Does that make any sense?
Yeah.
So it just sometimes feels quite futile, that it doesn't matter.
You could even say the ground displays itself as Ziggy's Zazen and Ziggy herself. You are not it, but it is you.
All that makes no sense.
Trying to think of it, the thought vanishes. Trying to speak of it, words end.
How do we conflate this trying to get to this idea of ground with letting go into and accepting not knowing?
Well, for one thing, I think that's one reason why I think it's nice to call the ground here and now, because then if we say trying to get to it, it doesn't make any sense, right? How do you get to here and now? So that's not knowing is another name for that. But sometimes expressing it as here and now might help us to settle into this not knowing. We can use words also to point towards the unspeakable. And so, without facing objects, it's illuminating. It shows itself silently, sitting throughout sky and earth. Only this whole body is exposed. This one is without compare. She has completely died. Eyes clear, she stands nowhere. Where is there any dust? What could obstruct such a one? Clear water has no back or front. Space has no inside or outside. Completely clear, its own luminosity shines before form and emptiness were separated by our thought. Objects of mind and the knowing mind itself have no opposition or duality. This has always already been so, but it's still without a name. That's the Zazen instruction for today. May our intention equally extend to every being and place with the true merit of Buddha's way. Beings are numberless. I vow to save them. Delusions are inexhaustible. I vow to end them. Dharma gates are boundless. I vow to enter them. Buddha's way is unsurpassable. I vow to become it.